This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. Do you have a question for Zorba? We have an open line for you right now at 1-800-462-7413. Along with our listener questions, Zorba, some interesting research.
Yes, we're going to talk about sweat. Male sweat, is there a difference between when men are sexually aroused or not? And can women tell the difference between the kinds of sweat and what does it mean? And we're going to talk about vitamin pills. Do they actually deliver or not? Information from the Women's Health Study.
Oh, that's been in the news. Mm-hmm. So many of our listeners already know about this, and we'll get Zorba's take coming up in a bit. 800-462-7413. Oh, and our recipe.
Yes, Marsha's mushroom and onion tilapia.
Oh, coming to us
from fish recipe.
Duluth, Minnesota listener Marsha Opine. That'll be coming up in about 25 minutes or so. Let's get to the phones. A listener with us now, Zorba, in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
I have a couple-part question here. I watched a famous female talk show host, and she has a famous doctor friend, and he was recommending...
You wouldn't be talking about Oprah by any chance.
I must be.
And Dr. Oz.
How did I ever guess that? Okay, go ahead.
And he's recommending numbers women should know. So at my last physical exam with my primary care physician, I requested some specific blood work so that I would know my cholesterol, triglycerides, etc., and specifically the C-reactive protein, which is new to me. And as a result, that C-reactive protein number came back what he called, quote, high, which was a 12.9.
Mm-hmm.
And the only recommendation he made was to take fish oil. I was concerned about this recommendation and wondering if that was enough. I have a strong history of heart disease in both sides of my family and have since found a new primary care physician, but I wanted Zorba's opinion on what I should do to lower this, if anything, and if there's any follow-up tests I can do to determine where this general inflammation is coming from.
Well, there are a couple of interesting issues. We now, when we look at heart disease, we have to look at it globally, and it's a constellation. You've looked up at the Big Dipper in the sky, I'm sure, and the Big Dipper is not one star. It's a bunch of different stars, so you can't take out one star and say, well, that's the Big Dipper, or the next star and say, that's the Big Dipper. You've got to look at the whole thing in a constellation. It is the same for heart disease. There's not one number that means it means anything. It's all the numbers, and if we add up all of our numbers together, we can only account for 50% of all the premature heart attacks in the United States. In other words, all the numbers, they don't predict anything. They only predict it about 50% of the time. On the other hand, they give us an idea of how to reduce risk. Just like you buckle up your seatbelt before you go outside doesn't mean you won't have an accident. Now, do you smoke?
No.
Good. Do you exercise?
I try to exercise 3 times a week, but I fall short.
Okay, but falling
short. Sometimes only once a week.
Yeah, but, you know, there's something with that. How's your height? How's your weight? Your height isn't going to change, but what about your weight?
I am overweight. Uh-huh. I'm 5'4", and I weigh a little under 200 pounds.
Okay, so that's something you can attack. That's very important. That's one issue you can attack. Your genes, you clearly can't attack. Now, you said you had a strong family history for heart disease. What do you mean? 50 years of age, did somebody have a heart attack, or at what age?
My brother had a heart attack at 47,
okay.
And my paternal grandfather had died from one around age 50.
Okay, so that is a strong family history. And basically, that means that the C-reactive protein, which is a measurement of inflammation, which we believe now may be a measure of another risk factor for premature heart attacks, indeed is present. So I think that this inflammatory marker of C-reactive protein for you really does mean something. So how do you reduce C-reactive protein? Well, first of all, once again, it's just a marker. It's not as if moving it down means you're going to have less heart disease. Keeping it neutral means you'll have more heart disease. We just know it's a risk factor in there. And it may be that which is causing early heart attacks in your family. So for you, the answer is diet and exercise. Keeping your cholesterol under control, making sure your LDL or bad cholesterol probably is below 100. Do you know what your bad cholesterol number was? That's the
LDL. My bad cholesterol cholesterol is 120.
That might be a little too high for you. That's where you got to sit with your doctor and say, look, I have C-reactive protein. I've got a strong family history. I've got an elevated C-reactive protein. That increases my risk factor. Maybe I should be on a statin to lower the risk of heart disease. And the next thing I would recommend besides an aspirin tablet every day is a glass of red wine with food, with dinner. You look at the Europeans, they don't have their 7 glasses of wine on Saturday night, mm-hmm. as many people do in my state of Wisconsin, but they have it with food. So that would be, those would be my recommendations. And I think the idea of looking at the C-reactive protein was great in your case.
Well, thank you so much for your help.
Thank you so much. We appreciate the call. Zorba, we've been sitting across from each other for a lot of years. I don't have a clue what C-reactive protein. What does that mean?
Well, C-reactive protein is a marker. The traditional C-reactive protein was a marker of inflammation. So it was something that we measured when people had rheumatoid arthritis and other things called autoimmune diseases, certain diseases where we develop antibodies that attack our body. Lo and behold, research recently has shown, and I'm talking about the last 5 to 10 years, more and more research has shown that a specific subgroup of C-reactive protein, sometimes it's called C-reactive protein-H, appears to be an inflammatory marker that may increase the risk of a heart attack. And let me explain that. You've got this cholesterol in your body. We've got plaques all over us. Some of us have a lot. Some of us have a little. But we believe it's the inflamed plaque that's more likely to rupture and cause a clot that causes a heart attack and stroke. And this may be a way of measuring that inflammation.
When I get my cholesterol checked and numbers back, is that one of the numbers
It may be one of the risk factors. Right now, the jury is out on how important that is compared to cholesterol. But again, if you've got a strong family history, if you're overweight, if you're not exercising right, you may want to get it. The real problem is if it's low, you may have reassurance, oh, I don't have to worry about my diet or exercise, even with a strong family history. If it's high, you go, well, I've got a strong family history, that motivates you to do even more. And it's really the lifestyle things you can modify. Because frankly, there's no evidence that we can modify C-reactive protein, even though there is one statin drug that reduces that, the drug called Crestor. Whether or not the reduction of that with Crestor reduces heart attacks, the jury is out on that.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. On we go, Zorba, to Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hello.
Hello.
How can we help?
I'm honored to talk to you guys.
Well, we're happy you called. How can we help you?
Well, I am 46 years old. And I have always been a very active, athletic person. In my late 30s, my doctor put me on Lipitor. It lowered my cholesterol, got it down below 200. Around October of 07, I came down with neuropathy in my feet. And It just totally freaked me out. I started doing some research myself, and I looked up statin drugs and neuropathy. And about the time that he increased me from 10 milligrams to 20 milligrams on Lipitor, it seemed like about a week after that I came down with neuropathy. And so I want to believe that there's some tie in there. The neurologist tells me it's just idiopathic now.
Now, to help me out here, what does it look like or feel like to have neuropathy on your feet?
Well, it feels like I've heard people describe it as a burning sensation or pins, but to me it almost feels like there's a constant frostbite on my feet, the bottom of my feet.
Is there any visual evidence of this?
No. In fact, the doctor told me I had very strong pedal pulses, and my feet actually look pretty good.
Okay, with neuropathy, it's a sensation. And neuropathy means, you know, bad nerve. I mean, that's what it is. But it means that you've got sometimes it's a numbness or a tingling. Sometimes it's a lack of sensation. Sometimes it's just an abnormal sensation. But that's basically what it means. And neuropathy, the most common cause of neuropathy in the U.S. today is diabetes.
Right.
So the first thing people have to check for is, are they a diabetic? Because that's a really common cause of it. And then there, if you look on any website and you put in neuropathy in Google, you'll find a whole list of things that can cause neuropathy. And the fact is, most times, we don't know what causes it. called idiopathic, which means we're idiots because we don't know what causes it, basically. In other words, we have no idea at all. Now, to my knowledge, statins do not cause neuropathy, and that was just coincidental. Now, but you noticed it went to 10 to 20 milligrams. I'm a great believer in individual differences, you know, where sometimes, you know, you increase a drug and a person has a side effect and you decrease it and it stops. So have you stopped your statin or have you stayed on it?
You know, I have stopped my statin.
Did the neuropathy go away?
It did not go away.
I don't think it was from the statin. I doubt very much. Because most of the time with statins, when you stop the drug, it goes away. And I can't, you know, once again, I don't think it is. Statins have been around now for a long time. They've been around for 20 years. It's not a known side effect to my knowledge of statins. And the fact is, if it was known side effect, since we have millions of people on it, I think that by now we would know that. Now, given that information, we don't really know. For a long time, we thought that ibuprofen and naproxen and other anti-inflammatories were safe. And then Vioxx came out, and we found out that actually they all cause an increase in heart attacks. So, and they were around for like 30 years before we figured it out. So given that, the chances are it's still unlikely it's caused by that, but maybe a few years down the line, we'll find out that you're right.
Well, let me ask you this. With no matter what the cause, Is there any way to reverse neuropathy, or how do you treat it other than just manage the pain?
That's all we can do. There's no way to reverse it. There are drugs that can be used. A drug called gabapentin can be used, and there's some other drugs that can be useful for this, but there's often no way to get rid of the neuropathy. It comes and goes on its own, and that's sort of what it does.
Okay.
Thank you very much for your
call.
All
right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Good luck to you. 800-462-7413. We do a lot of research talking here on the program. Some is more important than other. This is very, very important stuff. So listen up carefully.
Now, wait a second.
This research is the effect of sexual arousal in men on the smell of our sweat.
No, wait a second, Tom. No, wait a second. You are putting down this research, and this research is important. Now, think about it. If there were no sex, then the race would not continue with that, and everyone would die on the earth. I mean, look at Europeans. Look at Europeans. They're not even keeping up with their, they're not keeping up with their birth rate. It's not keeping up with their death rate. I mean, sex is crucial.
Okay, but I'm jumping to the bottom line before we get into it. The bottom line is there's no evidence that what we're talking about has anything to do with whether sex happens
I'm not so sure. Let's look at the study. We're looking at sweat. Now, there's sweat you get from going out exercising at the gym, and basically sweat cools your body. But then there are the apocrine glands. These are glands underneath your armpits, and they respond to sexual arousal. That's what they do. They're glands. Before you're a teenager, the apocrine glands don't work. After you're a teenager, they're there. And so what they wanted to do was see whether or not the smell, the odor from the apocrine glands would actually make a difference. So what they did is they put a bunch of guys, heterosexual guys, in front of what they call it erotic films. In normal language, we would call it porn.
Yeah, we know.
That's what we would say. And they put pads underneath their armpits, had them watch the porn, then took the pads off, put them away, put them probably in Ziploc bags somewhere. Then they had them watch a neutral movie. I have no idea what the neutral movie. Maybe It's a Wonderful Life. Now, I would think of that as a wonderful neutral movie, wouldn't you?
I don't know, I suppose.
Well, you know, that's it. Then what they did was they also looked at a pad moistened.
The English patient would be.
The English patient would be. Well, they
get to bore them to death.
You got to keep them awake while they're watching the movie.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And the English patient, well, maybe 20 minutes of the English patient would seem like an hour and a half in the movie. That would be of it.
Anyway.
It's guy stuff. Yeah. Then they also took a pheromone, a naturally occurring pheromone by the nickname of Andro. And they put that on pets. That's what they did. Okay, so now they took these three pads, the neutral pads, guys watching a neutral movies, the porn pads where the guys were watching porn, and the andro pads, and they gave them to women and said, sniff it and tell us if you're aroused. Quite an interesting study. And guess what?
And they looked in the brains, and they found that
they
there are different parts of the brain were affected by the different
Absolutely.
Pads.
They did MRI scans of the brain, and they found out that when they smelled the pads where the men were sexually aroused, they aroused different parts of the brains when they watched the pads where men were probably watching The English Patient or something equivalent to that. So what does this mean? It means that different smells arouse different parts of the brain. Now, how does that actually translate into sexual arousal? It's hard to know. Let me tell you guys, if you stop bathing, it's not necessarily going to attract women. That's the bottom line. But it's very interesting research that showed that smells play a role in our society. And basically, in our society in America, we wash the smells off of us. We don't like smells at all. So, but maybe for cave women, this was important.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, here's a listener with us now in Idaho Falls, Idaho. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help you?
Dr. Zorba, I'm an active middle-aged male in my mid-50s. I found out a few years ago that I'm going to need to have a hip replacement due to some degenerative arthritis in my hip. And I've been talking to a number of surgeons. Seems that the preference is for a total hip replacement. I'm looking at an option for a newer technique that I believe has been just recently approved by the Food and Drug Administration called resurfacing. And I'd like to get your guidance and thoughts on this. I've had several cortisone injections into the hip to try and deal with the pain, but I'm now at a point where I have to make a decision. And the more informed I could be, I thought the better it would be for myself.
Right. Hip resurfacing, by the way, has been very popular in Canada for a number of years, and it's becoming more and more popular in the U.S.
What is it exactly?
Well, a total hip replacement, you replace the ball and the socket of the hip. That's what it is. We know about it. We've been doing it in this country and in Europe for almost 3 decades.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's been
what
about 3 decades.
What is the resurfacing?
Resurfacing is where they actually just – it's a less – well, would I call it a less invasive procedure? It's less because we don't replace the socket. I mean, we don't replace, the upper part. We replace the ball and resurface the ball, but the socket basically stays the same. Mm-hmm. So in other words, you're not doing as much to the hip. It's less invasive in that. The recovery is said to be quicker. It's, you're back at work quicker, you're back at your game quicker. And for people with mild disease, this may be the way to go. And as it goes right now, it's sort of defined by the surgeon. The surgeons who say, well, I do a lot of resurfacing, it really works well, they go, well, in my hands, this is the way to go. And then in the surgeons that do total hip replacement, they say, well, we don't really think resurfacing works. You ought to have a total hip replacement. So back to you. Who have you talked to?
I've talked to a couple of surgeons that are hip and knee surgeons in Idaho, and then I've also talked to a few other surgeons outside of Idaho that have done the resurfacing for several years.
Okay.
And I'm pretty convinced that being an active male and like to try and continue my lifestyle of skiing and hiking and those type of things, that the resurfacing seems to be a better option for me, but I'm still trying to get closure on that decision.
But you hit exactly on as much closure as you're going to get. In other words,
okay,
that's the closure on the decision. There's no, okay, let's add it all up together. Does this fit exactly? And so I can be totally 100% sure that this is the right way to go. But I think given that you've gotten multiple, this is how you sort of handle
the gray zone.
He sure
did his homework, didn't he?
You did your homework. You talked to multiple people. What you want to do is ultimately go to a surgeon who does a lot of resurfacing. But you're going to get your best information by surgeons who do both resurfacing and total hips. Because
okay,
they're going to give you the best opinion. They're going to say, well, I think you're a total hip guy. I think you're a resurfacing guy, because you don't want somebody who just does A or B, because they're more likely to say, well, under my hands, this is going to be better. What you want is under my hands, they both work. I think you should have this one. And it's kind of 51-49 sometimes. That's where the gray zone, and then you go with your gut. Clearly, if you have the resurfacing and it doesn't work, you may need a total hip. That's the downside. On the other hand, the total hip limits some of the things that you can do.
Okay, that's great information. Thank you very much.
A pleasure.
We appreciate the call. Before we get to the recipe, Zorba, let's jump over to the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox to see if we can help out Carl, a retired professor from Springdale, Utah, with his sleep question. Carl writes, hi, Zorba and Tom. I got a problem, and you're part of it.
I'm part of his problem?
I used to get up early to do my research, and when we moved to Utah, I awake even earlier so that I get about 5 hours of sleep. I thought I'd get used to the time change and sleep later, but my local public radio station rebroadcasts your program at 3 a.m., and I get very interested. So, I've a habit of waking and listening at 3 each morning. Sometimes I drift back to sleep after listening, but most often stay awake and get up and start the day. I've heard of some recent research indicating it'd be good to get 8 hours of sleep. I want to know if it works as well to get a 5-hour batch at night and a 2 to 3 hour batch later in the day. What do you think? Well, bottom line, not listening to your program is not an option.
It's not an option.
Isn't that
well,
nice?
I love that. I think that's great. You know, people have different sleep patterns. Generally, you get a better, more restful sleep by having it all at one time. So, you know, 7 to 8 hours of sleep at a crack is great. But as we get older, as you know, our sleep is not as deep. And for some people, they will often sleep and can't nap during the day. Famous person who did that was Thomas Edison. He'd get 4 hours of sleep at night. He said that's all he needed, but he continuously napped throughout the day, and that's how he caught up. Whatever works for you and makes you feel refreshed is the way to go. And, you know, you do what we call good sleep hygiene. Make sure the room is right, the bed covers aren't too heavy, and so on. But I don't think you should leave Utah. I think you should stay exactly where you are.
We're here around the clock to help with your lifestyle questions, so keep them coming. Send them along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
A nice recipe coming up from a nice listener in Duluth, Minnesota. Lots more of your calls, some interesting research, our medical myth buster, all here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That number again, 800-462-7413. We have callers waiting, but a line open for you at 800-462-7413. But before our next call, it is, of course, recipe time. So let me welcome Duluth, Minnesota listener Marcia Opine. Marcia, hi.
Hi, welcome.
Glad to have you with us, and thanks so much for submitting this recipe for Moe's mushroom and onion tilapia. Did I pronounce that right?
As well as anyone can.
As well as anyone can. Now I've got a question. You're in Duluth. I mean, I've heard there's a nickname for Duluth. What is that nickname?
Dr. Zorba, our nickname for Duluth is the Swedish Riviera.
I can just imagine all those Swedes out there in bathing suits in Duluth in the wintertime,
right.
just kind of relaxing.
Now, before we get to the ingredients, Moe's mushroom and onion tilapia, your name is Marcia Opine. Who's Moe?
Well, people refer to me as Mo because no one can ever pronounce my last name because of the spelling.
Ah.
And usually the first name sets it off because it isn't the common spelling of Marcia. So usually it's Marcia Opian. And so I just go by Mo.
That's exactly it. The joys of nicknames in America. Now, I've got a question for you. I happen to love tilapia. I mean, I mispronounce it all the time, but I love the fish. What I like about it is it's inexpensive, and it's easy to get a hold of, and it really does very well as a frozen fish. How long have you been eating tilapia? I mean, frankly, 10 years ago, I never even heard of tilapia. It's become much more common because it's on the whole farm-raised fish.
Well, probably a couple of years.
Yeah, how'd you come up with this recipe?
Well, my cousin Nancy O'Hearn, I must give her credit. She had the original recipe. She made it for us at her cabin a couple of summers ago, and I ran out of some of her ingredients in the recipe, so I came up with the Marcia version of her recipe.
Got it. Exactly. One of the things I like about recipes, I like two kinds of recipes, either a unique special flavor that has lots of ingredients on one hand, and then I like simplicity on the other hand. One of my favorite cookbooks that I gave all of my kids when they went off to college was Cooking with Four Ingredients. And the idea was, how do we make something that's delicious with a few ingredients? And we have six ingredients here. That's all. And it makes it something that's easy to sort of rustle.
So let's put it together.
So let's start out. Start out with 2 tablespoons of olive oil.
2 big tea olive oil.
1 large sweet onion slice. What kind of onion do you use? Use a red onion or a white onion or a...
Usually I use a large white sweet onion, but you can use red or anything you want.
Mm-hmm. And there really are differences between, often between the way onions taste and definitely between the way that they look.
Yep.
So 1 large sweet onion sliced, 2 packages of mushrooms. Now, how many mushrooms? Is that 8 ounces, 16 ounces? How much do you use?
They are about 6 by 6. You know, I don't know ounce-wise.
They're the large packages or the small ones? Maybe
the
that's the better.
The large packages.
The large.
And I always use portobello mushrooms because they look better and they taste better.
Wow. And portobello mushrooms are delicious. They cost more a bit than the regular mushrooms, but you save on the fish, so you might as well spend it on the mushrooms. So 2 packages of mushrooms, mm-hmm. portobello if you can get them, if you can get them. 1/3 cup of dry vermouth or white wine, and you use vermouth all the time?
I do, ever since we started listening to you. And thank you for that tip.
Exactly. And that, for me, came from Cooks Illustrated, where they did a taste test. They looked at white wine for several recipes. They looked at inexpensive vermouth and expensive vermouth. And lo and behold, they found the cheapest vermouth that you get on the whole produces the best taste. So I use Gallo vermouth, which is about $3.50 or $4 a bottle, and it kind of lasts for a long time.
That's a gallon bottle, right?
That's a gallon bottle. Gosh, that would be a lot of vermouth. 3 cloves of garlic pressed.
3 cloves of garlic pressed.
And 4 tilapia steaks, basically tilapia fillets.
Or tilapia,
if you
want to pronounce it correctly.
You know, I'll never get it right. So the grammar police beware. I pronounce it all over the place. Such is life.
Now, tell me this, if you will, Marcia. To satisfy Zorba and anybody else who can't pronounce tilapia, could we use another fish? Something like maybe...
like salmon, you
mean? Yeah.
Sure, you could use salmon. I've used walleye, fresh walleye, or brook trout.
You can say walleye,
I can
right?
say walleye. Yeah. You know what I can really say? You know what I'm good at saying? Cod.
Oh.
Cod. I am so good at saying cod, really. I am the king when it comes to cod pronunciation. I've even read the book called Cod, which, by the way, is a great read if you're looking for a book about fish, all about cod. Okay, so let's make it.
Okay.
Heat the olive oil in a large skillet.
Mm-hmm.
Add the onions and mushrooms over medium heat and sauté until the mushrooms are translucent and bronze. About how long is that, that you heat the onions and mushrooms? How long?
Oh, maybe 5 minutes. It really depends how small you chop your onions and mushrooms.
Mm-hmm. When you chop your onions, well, you slice the onions, you chop the mushrooms. Do you make them kind of chunky or do you make them tiny?
I chop them in chunks just because it's faster, and I really am sensitive to onions. They really make me cry, so the less I touch them, the better.
Got you. So that's right. Then add the vermouth and cook about 1.5 minutes more until bubbly. Then add the garlic, and then place the tilapia steak on top of the onion and mushroom mix. Cover and reduce the heat. Cook for 7 or 10 minutes or until the fish is done. That's generally what it is. These are thin fillets. Serve with the onion and mushroom mixture surrounding the fish.
Mm-hmm.
I probably, if I had some parsley, would put a little parsley on top, sort of for color, because I like to do that if I have friends over at the house.
You could have a green veggie that goes along with it.
Green veggie on the side, maybe a nice side salad, maybe some good crusty bread. I'm in heaven. This is a delicious recipe, 240 calories a day. I'm ready to travel to the Swedish Riviera and have Marcia's, or Moe's, either way you can say it, mushroom and onion tilapia.
And if you ever are in Duluth, I will certainly fix this.
We'll all be in our swimming suits.
In the snow.
In the snow.
In Duluth, having the fish. Thank you very much. Great recipe.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Marcia, for sending us this winning recipe. Marcia gets a free copy of our cookbook, Heart Healthy, Low-Fat, Guilt-Free, and Tasty Recipes from the Kitchen of Zorba Pastor. And if you want to enter our recipe contest, it's easy. Just email your original low-fat recipe to us at
Zorba@WPR.org.
And if you want a copy of today's recipe, visit our website at
ZorbaPastor.org. You can look at that recipe, look at the other recipes that we have archived, and sign up for our weekly podcast. That's at ZorbaPastor.org.
That phone number again is 800-462-7413. And Zorba, we welcome a listener now in Watertown, Wisconsin. Hello.
Hello.
How can we help you?
Oh, I'm wondering, a friend of mine told me from a friend, from a doctor, that if you have, like, nuts, that'll stir up your arthritis. I can't believe that if you take, like, a handful, say maybe 10 almonds every other day and eat them, that'll stir up your arthritis. You know, or even like a handful of mixed nuts every other day, you know, and you, of course, you would have regular peanuts in with mixed nuts. But I was wondering if that'll cause arthritis to flare up because
Do you have arthritis?
Yes, I do. Very bad.
Have you tried nuts?
Yes, I have, and I really haven't noticed anything. I can't say that I've noticed any flare up. But I would assume if you eat more, maybe then it would. At least it seemed like it did with me. But that was when I ate a large quantity. So, you know, like you got a bowl full and you shuck peanuts. Then I've noticed that, but not with my mixed nuts, I haven't.
Okay, well, a couple of things first of all. Peanuts and mixed nuts are very different. Peanuts are not a nut.
Right.
The peanut is a legume, and we call them peanuts, but they're not a nut. Nuts are from trees. They're different. They're nuts and seeds, but nuts come from trees. And so we have walnuts, cashews, pistachios. They're in a whole other group. Neither peanuts nor mixed nuts, as you might call them, have any effect on arthritis at all. None at all. Zero.
What about if they're salted? Does the salt have any effect?
Not in the least. Now, salt, which we know isn't good for us in large quantities, may cause you to retain water. That may cause more pain in your feet, more pain in your joints, and may lead to more discomfort. Yeah. So you're right. You picked up the salt may actually have an effect because when we take salt, sometimes people swell up, and that causes pain and discomfort. So that's an effect. But the nut itself really doesn't have any effect. And for years, people have looked for foods that may make your arthritis better and worse, and frankly, we haven't found that. Now, I assume that in the background, that's your dog also giving advice.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
Oh, no problem. I listen to my dog all the time, and he usually believes what I believe. So I'm a dog lover. That's my belief. But anyway, nuts, don't worry about them and enjoy them. And nuts are good for your heart because they have omega-3 fatty acids, not peanuts, but regular nuts are good for your heart. And as Tom said, you want to have the unsalted variety. It's better.
Oh, thank you very much. I sure appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
The salted ones taste so much better.
Yes, they do, don't they?
Let's check in on the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox, Zorba, and see if we can help out Elise from Durango, Colorado. She writes, a friend of mine gets stomach pain in the form of shooting pains or cramps when he drinks certain juices. It started with apple juice, but now it has spread to almost all fruit juices and some fruits. It is worse for him in the morning, but now it happens all throughout the day. The other day, when he was drinking a watermelon slush, it caused the same reaction almost immediately after just one sip. What do you think this could be?
That's puzzling. That's absolutely puzzling. It's very difficult to say. One thing I think we can't say about juice is a concentrated form of calories. So we have to be very careful with juice. If you eat an orange, you're going to get the pulp in the orange. You're going to get the other benefit from fiber in the orange. If you drink orange juice, you can often get, you'll drink twice as much juice as having a full orange. So generally, I tell people, go to the fruit and try to reduce the juice. But what this reaction is, I don't have the foggiest idea what would actually cause it. What do you think, Tom?
Could be mental.
Could be mental. That could be it. Could also be how cold the juice is. Some people do not respond well to super cold drinks of any sort. We know that people can get headaches, called the ice cream headache, from drinking things that are too cold. So all I would say is, this is reaction. Reduce the juice. Go for the fruit. And if you do have juice, make sure it's not too cold.
Well, if something is cramping your style, we want to help. Send your questions, comments, and tips in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Now, Zorba, a listener with us in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hi.
Hey, how are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
Well, there's something that I have been doing for quite some years, off and on, which is, since I live in Tennessee, I call it Appalachian resistance training, which is drinking beer while I lift weights.
Drinking beer while you lift weights?
Appalachian resistance training.
Drinking beer while you lift weights. Now, that's very interesting.
I'm talking, you know, like having two or three light beers while you might work out for an hour, and I listen to National Public Radio and kind of relax in my basement and do that. Uh-huh. So, and I'm very trim. I'm 44. I weigh, you know, like 165 pounds, and I just wondered if it was, I shouldn't be doing that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, having a couple of beers a day is okay. Two drinks a day for a man, one drink a day, or a drink and a half a day for women, depending on their size, really has been shown to be heart healthy. We know, and every time I talk about this, I always get email, but we know that teetotalers, now this excludes alcoholics who can't drink alcohol. That's a totally different thing. Take away the alcoholics. People who by choice do not drink have a higher incidence of heart disease and stroke. Study after study after study has shown this. And we don't know why. We know that it's not the grapes in red wine. We know that it's the alcohol. And we don't know if it's the relaxation from the alcohol or a direct effect from the alcohol. So the fact is, whether or not you drink your beer at night in front of the tube, you know, or your glass of wine at night in front of the tube, or when you're having dinner, or whether or not you drink it when you're doing your resistance training, probably doesn't make any difference.
What?
I certainly have never seen
he's
that.
He's listening to public radio while he's doing that training.
That's true, actually.
It makes a huge
You know what?
Difference.
That makes the difference. That is your shield against the side effects of alcohol. You're right, Tom. Absolutely right. Public radio is your shield. As long as you keep the public radio on, man, you're okay. It is okay to do it. You can then drink beer while you're doing it. Now, I've got a question. Is this the Appalachian way of doing weight training? Is this individual, or is this sort of common practice?
I don't know how many others got.
Well, maybe they do. You know, we've
never
done a survey to find out how common it is to sit down. I mean, why does it have to be fruit juice when you're, you know, with high fructose corn syrup that'll add on weight? Why can't it be a beer? I mean, you're right.
Well, that's exactly the way I think of it. I think of it as, you know, it's made from grain. I just think it's like liquid cereal.
I agree. It's kind of cereal. Yeah, we could. I think we can do something better for the Miller and the Bud commercials, and we can say use it, you know, instead of Gatorade, light beer while you're exercising. We've got a whole new way of looking at beer. I like it.
Yeah.
But seriously, you know, you can drink two drinks. There's no evidence of when you drink it makes a difference. Some people say it ought to be with food because that's the way they do as a Mediterranean diet, but I think you're just fine. Two drinks a day are just okay. And keep up the good work with exercise and support public radio.
Thanks a lot for calling. More coming up here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. We have more of your calls, of course, some more interesting research, our medical myth buster, right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again, 800-462-7413. But research time before we take our next call. Very interesting, I think, Zorba. This made the news a while back. A study on multivitamins, which apparently shows that multivitamins have no effect whatsoever on cancer have no effect whatsoever on heart disease.
Well, it's an interesting study. And let's look at the study and see what it is. First of all, it's the Women's Health Study. So, you know, this is a study that was done by a number of women, a huge number of women, over a period of years, over a period of about 8 years, about 160,000 women. Some took a multivitamin, some did not take a multivitamin. They looked at cancer and heart disease. Initial data seemed to show that those who took a multivitamin did better, but the final data showed it really didn't do anything at all. And so what do we do? You know, vitamin industry is a huge industry. We're talking about a $20 billion a year industry for vitamins. And we know from other studies that this is in keeping with some other work. We know that some vitamins are harmful. We know that the carrot study, as it was called, the beta carotene study, showed that men who took beta-carotene, who smoked cigarettes, at a higher rate of lung cancer. So that clearly showed beta-carotene sort of went to the side. We now know from the Physician's Health Study that large doses of C and E don't seem to have any effect at all. So how do you interpret this?
It's
very difficult.
I noticed in the reading about the study that they say it's a little difficult to double-blind this because you can't really get a test group that doesn't have any vitamin intake.
Right, and that's because, among other things, the way that we got rid of vitamin deficiencies in our society is we started fortifying food. So anyone who eats fortified white bread, which is most of the white bread made in the country, I'm not talking about good bread that's made in a bakery.
Yeah.
If they use, and it may be that good bread, if it uses, quote, enriched flour, then enriched flour is enriched with vitamins. So we're actually getting vitamins in with the bread that we have. And then, of course, how do you, you know, you've got 160,000 women. Well, some of them eat more fruits and veggies than others.
Sure, of course.
And these are, and what they do is they send out questionnaires during the study. They give them pills, but four times a year they send out questionnaires and they say, how many servings of fruits and vegetables do you get a week? Well, I can't remember what I had for dinner last night, let alone what I had for the last 3 months. So this is very difficult to actually control.
After this study, where are you now, Zorba, on taking multivitamins?
Well, I still think a multivitamin that is cheap and inexpensive that you can buy for $10 to $20 a year, make sure that you get folic acid and B12. And this study doesn't dissuade me from doing that because I think it's a cheap thing that's there. But the new vitamin on the block is vitamin D. The study that will come out on vitamin D to show whether or not it works or doesn't work is still up in the air. So I would still take my daily vitamin, but don't give up the fruits and veggies.
800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. A listener with us now in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello.
Hello there.
How can we help?
I have a question concerning my fingertips, which I'm a cook and my hands are constantly in water, whether it's doing dishes or washing them. And I have found the only thing that works to actually help them heal up is super glue. And I'm wondering if that is, if I should or should not be using that on my skin.
No, seal up from what? From what kind of wear and tear? What do they look like?
Well, they crack. Mostly it's in the cold weather. But they crack open, like on, you know, the parts of my fingers that I use the most usually, and sometimes not. And I think it's mostly just from being dry and, you know, that and using them a lot and having them in and out of water. Like
well, I've used that super glue, and it gets on your hands all the time, and it feels icky. Doesn't it feel icky when you put that on your fingers?
It feels better than having an open wound that is really, I mean, they're very tender.
Right. Those wounds are tender. Before I talk about the super glue, now, how often do you wash dishes all the time?
Oh, sure, yeah.
You wear gloves?
No.
Always. That's the first thing you do. Buy rubber gloves and use them when you wash dishes. That's absolutely important because detergent is very, very harmful to the hands over time.
Mm-hmm.
And, for instance, for myself, when I started, 10 years ago, my fingers cracked all the time because here I am. I'm in the office, washing my hands continuously in the office. When I'm home, I'm, you know, my wife and I, you know, we've got kids. We've got to clean up all the time. And as soon as I started using rubber gloves, I noticed a major difference. So I recommend rubber gloves. And once you get used to rubber gloves, it's very hard to go back to washing dishes without them. So I highly recommend rubber gloves as something you can do. The second thing you want to do is when you're using any soap on your hands, use it minimally. Use something like Dove soap. Do not use a drying soap like Dial or Zest or Lifebuoy or Irish Spring because you don't want to dry out your hands. And the soapless cleansers, things like Purell is the most common name brand, are actually less drying to the hands because they often have a moisturizer than soap is. Absolutely. And I started doing that in the office 2 years ago. When I go in between patients now, I come in the room, I use the soapless cleanser, and my fingers are wonderful. They do not dry out nearly as much. So that's step number one, rubber gloves, soapless cleanser. Step number two is, it turns out super glue is dynamite. It's safe for the body. It's something called methyl methacrylate. That's the name of what's in super glue. And frankly, it's the same plastic type chemical as we use for inserts in the eye when we put in artificial lenses after you have a cataract operation. It's actually the same kind of a plastic compound. It's neutral to the body. It's safe. It's cheap. It's inexpensive. And it's great to use. It's one of the things we would bring on scout camping trips. If a kid had a cut, usually a kid, sometime an adult, would have a cut and it would start to bleed, we'd put on super glue and it would keep it there. So it is safe and effective to use.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Sure, we appreciate the call. That makes sense to me, except for the putting on the gloves to wash the dishes thing.
Yeah.
I wash dishes all the time, and it's so simple. You just push a couple of buttons and close the door. Why would I want to have gloves on for that?
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Tom.
Time now, Zorba, for our medical myth buster. We have a listener myth today from Tom in College Station, Texas, and it has to do with yet another home remedy with honey. He writes, I've been told that eating local honey is good for your allergies, at least those due to pollen. The argument is that since the bees use local pollen in making the honey, it's a cheap equivalent of an allergy shot.
I don't think so. I don't think so at all. I think there's a myth. There's absolutely no scientific evidence for this. Now, some will argue, well, no large honey company is going to, you know, is going to actually do the study because it's got to be local honey, so we don't have the data. That's true. But there's no evidence that eating pollen or eating honey or eating chopped up bees or eating what's called, you know, jelly, royal jelly, which is made in the hive, ever affects allergies at all. So I think the best way to treat allergies on the whole is not to eat honey, not to have the shots, but to take your antihistamine and get a steroid nasal spray. I think the honey thing is kind of a myth.
Yeah. Is this another one from the internet, do you suppose?
Oh, gosh. There are so many myths in the internet that it's hard to even take a breath and figure out the numbers.
Have a myth you'd like Zorba to bust? Send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
800-462-7413, the toll-free number. See if we can help a listener now, Zorba, in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hello.
What's up?
Oh, nothing. I'm 19 years old, and I started smoking cigarettes at a young age, and I just recently quit, and I started exercising regularly 3 times a week. And when I jumped on the treadmill, I was totally out of breath after 10 minutes of running, and I wanted to know what foods or certain exercise can get your lungs back in tip-top shape.
Well, first of all, it's great that you quit. And there was a recent study that actually showed when companies pay people to quit, they're more likely to quit. This particular company was GE, and workers got up to $750 if they quit for a year or 2 years. How'd you quit? And what age did you start? You said you started at a young age. For some of us, 19 is considered young, but it's all relative. How old were you when you started?
A little before 16, actually.
A little before 16. And how much did you smoke a day?
I would say a little less than a pack a day.
Okay,
but it wasn't all the way up till 19.
Uh-huh, got you. So that was it. Okay, and how long ago did you quit?
About a month ago.
Okay. This is what happens. The lungs regenerate. 3 years of smoking, you know, causes some damage, but the chances are at your age you're going to get lots and lots of benefit from this. The damage was minimal. You'll get it back, and the amount of lungs that you actually lost in 3 years of smoking at your age is marginal. But it takes about 6 months to a year to get back. And frankly, the way you get it back is through regular exercise and staying away from smoke and environments. So if you go to a bar and it's a smoky bar, you want to stay away from it, among other things, because you're more likely to go back to smoking if you have a drink and people are smoking around you. So I would stay out of smoky bars. That's the big thing. And I would exercise. And what you'll find is you'll get it back, but it's going to take a while. It takes about 6 months to a year. No special food, by the way, will do it. But you're still at risk a month out of there. Now, I've got a question. How did you quit, and how many times did you try to quit before you did it?
Actually, my friends are shocked, and they kind of hate me for it, but I just cold turkeyed it and put the pack away.
I've got to tell you, more power to you. Whatever works is the way to do it. For some people, they need the patch, they need the pill, they need the gum. Whatever works is important to work. And you were able to do it with, just with iron will. And the most important issue is you don't want to go back to it. Now, do you go out to bars where people smoke?
He's 19 years old.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. He doesn't go out to bars with people. Oh, that's right. I'm still stuck in the old
days. And if he does, he isn't going to tell us about it.
Now, wait a second. He's 19 years old. I can still ask if he goes out to bars. Be careful if you're on alcohol and cigarettes, because you're more likely to go back to it. So take care.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, we appreciate the call. And speaking of lungs, Zorba, before we leave, let's take a quick question from Joe in Mercer, Wisconsin. Joe asks, what actually happens to your body and lungs when a person gets the wind knocked out of them? Do the lungs get all available air really knocked out of them? And why does it take a few minutes to get back to breathing normal?
Well, first of all, what happens is when you have the wind knocked out of you and you all of a sudden we've all had that happen to us, all of a sudden we have to take a deep breath. We have the sensation almost of drowning. We have the sensation that we're just not going to get the air back into us, even though we may have just as much air as if we held our breath. Mm-hmm. So it's the muscular proprioceptive, if you will, idea that we're never going to be able to take the deep breath, and we're gasping because we're afraid. It's a very natural response because you feel like you're suffocating. So there's the psychological, physiological response that's going on. I've got to get that air in me right away. Mm-hmm. But what may be happening if you get the wind knocked out is you actually have enough air, just like if you hold your breath. You actually may have enough oxygen in you. And it's getting over the fright that takes the time. And that's why it takes 1 or 2 or 3 minutes, because you're frightened that you're suffocating. And it's a natural response, because that's what we have to do. If we're suffocating, we got to get that air back into us right away.
Pretty interesting. We want to hear from you, of course. Send us your thoughts in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Zorba, I'll see you next week.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at zorbapastor.org.
Don't forget, Adam is available anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio, produced by Adam Friedrich. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director, and Charles Monroe Kane is surfing in South Padre right now. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
National support for Zorba Pastor on Your Health comes from the AED Superstore, helping people save lives with Philips HeartStart automated external defibrillators for business, school, travel, and home. Available at AEDSuperstore.com. Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0307Z.
PRI, Public Radio International.